Are vegans actually unhealthy?
Does cannabis ruin your sleep?
And why are so many men taking testosterone supplements? I'm Mitch.
And I'm Greg.
And we're the creators of the popular YouTube channel ASAP Science.
Every week on our podcast Side Note by ASAP Science, we explain the science behind a controversial subject with recent research, up-to-date studies, and ridiculous stories so you are entertained while, bam, simultaneously learning.
We're here to make science make sense.
Download Side Note by ASAP Science wherever you get your podcasts.
Let's pretend for 1 second that you are smart and young and lucky. We'll go back about a decade and we'll say that you're just graduating from completing an undergrad degree. You've got some student loans, but nothing crazy. And you managed to immediately land a decent, full-time entry-level job in your field. So you're growing up, you're paying down your debt, you're saving a little money, and soon you'll be ready to buy a house and settle down and maybe even start a family if that's your thing. And if that was you around, say, 2011 or 2012, I'm going to imagine that what you're about to hear has been part of the soundtrack of your life for about the last decade.
What has continued to grow are house prices in some of Canada's biggest cities.
The average home price in this country was over $570,000.
A Vancouver condo listed at just under $900,000 sold in 6 days. It sold over asking.
After Toronto's housing prices dipped ever so slightly in March, the trend continues back on the upswing.
Many millennials say buying a home these days is just not an option.
Yes, Canada's housing market is hot. It's been scorching for nearly a decade. Even a global pandemic couldn't cool it off. You heard in those clips about Toronto and Vancouver, but it's way, way beyond that. We have done episodes of this podcast about unaffordable housing in places like Nunavut and in Prince Edward Island. And as the pandemic has made it less necessary for people to live downtown in places like Toronto and Vancouver, guess what's happened in these smaller, cheaper communities, a little ways up or down the road? So, is this the world's biggest housing bubble, or is this just now reality in Canada? How has our housing market changed in the past year? And how could it change when COVID is eventually over? And what will happen to some of Canada's smallest but hottest housing markets if the bubble does burst? I'm Jordan Heath Rawlings. This is The Big Story. Mike Moffitt is an economist, and he is the senior director at the Smart Prosperity Institute in Ottawa. Hey, Mike.
Hello.
Maybe you could start with the basics for us. How do housing prices in Canada right now compare with similar countries in the world or compare with even our recent past?
Well, we're seeing a house price boom across developed countries. So in Canada, depending on the market, prices are up anywhere from 5 to 40%. We're seeing similar gains in the United States and in Western Europe. And it's caused by a couple of things. First, we have a group of individuals that I call sort of white-collar professionals who are staying at home, they haven't been taking vacations, they're not commuting, and they are saving a lot of money. And they're taking that money and using it to buy all sorts of things. So we're seeing huge price increases in the stock market, in Bitcoin, things like vintage guitars and old hockey cards. So they're pumping their money into that. And many of them are buying houses. They're buying second homes as investment properties, which is boosting the price of those. And then we couple that with globally low interest rates, which allow people to finance the purchase of homes even cheaper than they would have been able to a year ago. It's just fueling this massive boom where, again, in markets all across Canada and in particularly smaller markets like Ingersoll and Tillsonburg and markets like that, you know, we're seeing price increases of 40% or more.
Well, I want to get to these small communities in a minute. But first, you know, you mentioned over the past year, but, you know, as somebody who's lived in Toronto for a long time, it feels like this has been happening forever. Like, I don't remember the time that we weren't talking about the housing bubble.
Yeah, absolutely. So across southern Ontario, since about 2015 or so, we've seen some pretty massive price increases. And in the Toronto market, it goes well before then. And it's driven by somewhat different dynamics than what we're seeing in the pandemic. Again, the pandemic dynamics are really driven by a whole host of cheap money, of people with a lot of savings who are dumping it into the housing market. Over the previous years before the pandemic, we saw a big increase in population growth that in a typical five-year period, Ontario grows by about 600 to 700,000 people a year. Well, between 2015 and 2020, that was over a million people a year. So we almost doubled our rate of growth. And that was due to an influx of international students. It was due to an influx of workers on visas, you know, the two-week express entry, along with increases in our immigration targets. So we had, you know, more people chasing the sort of same number of houses. So we saw this big rise in prices over the last 5 years. And now on top of that fire, you know, we have this situation where we have a lot of money and a lot of people buying investment properties, which is boosting up these prices.
Is that similar to what's happening in Vancouver right now, which, again, is the other place? And we're going to get to the rest of the country in a second. But, you know, those are the two places that your mind immediately goes when you think about crazy housing in Canada.
Well, it looks like a lot of what we saw over Vancouver the last few years. Now, interestingly enough, Vancouver hasn't been one of the hottest real estate markets during the pandemic. It's only been up about 10 to 15%. Hmm. But that said, it does look like Vancouver from a few years ago, where you have this combination of population growth coupled with individuals using housing as a form of investment to really drive up prices. So it does have some similarities to the Vancouver market, though, again, somewhat surprisingly, Vancouver isn't one of the hottest housing markets these days.
I'm going to ask what is probably a really dumb question, but if this has been going on in cities like Toronto and Vancouver for a long time now, and, you know, the growth has been pretty steady, why are we still calling it a bubble? Is this a bubble? What does that term mean in this sense?
Well, a bubble is prices that are disconnected from the underlying fundamentals, that it's driven by a form of investment mania. You know, again, the same thing that drove up the price of game stock, or, you know, the tulip mania from 400 years ago. So I would think actually in Toronto and markets like that, you know, yes, prices are up significantly, but you can make a decent argument that it's in part driven by fundamentals. It's in part driven by population growth. Where I get a little bit more concerned during the pandemic is markets, more sort of rural and remote markets like a North Bay, Ontario, which is still up 15 to 20% year over year, despite the fact that the population really isn't growing all that much. So I think there is a combination of things going on. Like, I do think there is a bubble in the sense that there is some speculative mania going on. But in your larger markets, in your Toronto, Vancouver, and surrounding region, there are also, you know, underlying fundamentals about why these housing prices would go up. And again, it's just too many families chasing too few homes.
So what's going on then in North Bay, or you mentioned Ingersoll earlier? What's happening in those markets now?
Well, a lot of it is people buying second properties, but again, particularly in your more rural or remote. Small town southwestern Ontario, though, is, again, a bit of a different dynamic. And it's one of the things that makes it hard to talk about the real estate market in Canada is it's not sort of a unified market that you have all of these little regional markets that are all driven by a bunch of different things. And we've seen over the last few years that, you know, as the Toronto market, you know, going back 6, 7, 8 years ago, got very tight, as those prices started going up and as families started getting priced out, they started to move to places like Kitchener-Waterloo and Guelph and Barrie. And then those places got expensive. So families looking to buy a home in Kitchener got price of the markets, and they moved to Brantford. And then, you know, Brantford got expensive, and those families moved to Tillsonburg. And I call that the musical chairs effect, that basically what happens is one market gets expensive, so people move to the next market down the 401 or 403. That housing market gets expensive, and so on. And we've seen that again since about 2015, where, you know, the further and further away you get from the CN Tower, eventually those markets are starting to heat up. And over the last few years, you know, some of the hottest housing markets we've seen have been in relatively smaller communities across southwestern Ontario, again, as people look to buy homes. So Thorold, Ontario, which is, you know, kind of between Hamilton and St. Catharines, you know, it's been one of the hottest housing markets over the last few years. Woodstock and Ingersoll, you know, which is between London and Kitchener, kind of same thing, that, you know, families are looking for a place to live. And often the bigger cities, and again, even the Kitchener, Waterloo's in London, have gotten a little expensive. So people look to a Woodstock, a St. Thomas, a Sarnia, you know, a community like that.
What does that do to those communities, though? I mean, you mentioned kind of the musical chairs moving out from Toronto. What about the people who live in Ingersoll who might have been expecting, as they went off to college or wherever, to come back and buy a reasonably priced home? Where do they go?
Yeah, so it has some interesting regional dynamics to it. So absolutely, we are seeing people in those small to mid-sized communities get priced out of the market. That, you know, a 22-year-old who thought that, you know, they'd be able to work in that community and afford a house in the community are finding that they're not able to, and they're having to move down the road, which is problematic. It's also problematic that they're often, you know, taking the jobs in Kitchener or Waterloo, but having to live somewhere that's, you know, 45 or 50 minutes away and commuting, right? So it causes a fair bit of congestion and sprawls. There is an upside, though, that some of these smaller communities have been in economic decline. You know, they have aging population. And it's seeing an influx of young families, and it's revitalizing a lot of smaller communities. So there is an upside to it, but it is the kind of thing that we have to manage. And it was largely unexpected. If we go back to 2015 and we look at population forecasts, we didn't really see this population growth, and communities really weren't prepared for that. So, you know, we weren't forecasting these house price increases and these tight markets. And in fact, if you go back to 2013 to 2015, we were calling it a housing bubble back then. And, you know, you can read the Globe and Mail and other newspapers and say, oh, you know, prices are so high, you know, this is a house of cards and this is going to collapse. And prices have doubled to tripled since then.
The Big Story will be back in just a minute. When you talk about the influx of young families into smaller communities, and you say, you know, this is something that we've got to manage, how do you manage something like that? What can you do if you're a government to control it or try to manipulate it to capture the best parts of it and prevent the worst? I don't know.
Well, I think part of it is making sure that we have enough housing in our larger cities so that the people who want to live in a Kitchener-Waterloo or a Toronto or a Milton can actually get a home there. So part of it is having that sort of property planning in those larger communities. As well, in the smaller communities, we're going to have to think through things like schooling and hospitals. You know, over the last 30, 40 years, we've been closing a lot of rural schools, and now we're finding that, in fact, we need them open again. Huh. So, you know, it's incumbent on mostly municipal governments, but the provincial governments as well, to, you know, really understand what's going on in the ground and take that into account when they're deciding, you know, which hospitals to expand, where to put schools, and those sorts of things.
You know, you mentioned that a lot of this has been driven by the pandemic over the past year, at least. What do you see happening? You know, I always say, like, knock on wood, because God only knows at this point what's next. But, you know, what do you see happening, assuming by September, October, we're all vaccinated and, you know, go into ball games and everything again? How does that change, or how could it change the dynamic of the housing market?
I think the quickest way to appear foolish is to make a house price prediction. They
yes,
tend not to
enough.
Age very well. And I was mocking all of those people back in 2013 to 15, saying that there was a bubble and it was going to crash, and they ended up being wrong. But so instead of making a prediction, I think I'll talk about two possible outcomes. So the first is that there may be a correction. And I actually do think we are going to see a pullback in prices somewhat. It's just a matter of degree. Prices going to flatline or go down 5%, or are we going to see sort of a 1980s style correction where they go down 30%? Mm-hmm. Though, again, in a lot of markets, even if housing prices went down 30%, they'd still be up from where they were this time last year.
Wow.
So we might see that. We might see investors who bought second properties or individuals who have a house in Toronto, but also have a house in Bob Cajun because they realized that they could, you know, work remotely for last year. They might put one of those properties on the market, and that could, that could cause a price decline. On the other hand, you know, we may see these house prices persist again, particularly if after the pandemic we have a return of the international students, we have a return of our tech companies and other companies using the Express Visa system. You know, we've already got a federal government who is expanding immigration targets. So, you know, there's no guarantee of a large correction. You know, there's sort of an obvious possible path to a correction, but there is also the possibility that these high home prices may persist for some time.
How much of it has to do with what those large employers in major cities decide to do? You know, we had Matt Lundy of the Globe and Mail on the show last week, and he mentioned that new businesses are starting up because there's so much cheap rental office space available. And, you know, I don't think anybody knows yet whether or not those huge corporations like Rogers, who owns this podcast, is going to send me back to the office and send all 30,000 Toronto workers back to the office. And how could that either help or hurt house prices?
Well, it will certainly affect house prices. So, and we don't know how this is going to turn out. So, you know, one of the ways it might affect home prices is depending on whether or not work from home persists and to what degree. In a world where there's a lot of work from home, then, you know, living in a Bob Cajun or a Tilsonburger in Ilderton or an Ingersoll looks a lot more attractive because you're not driving down to downtown Toronto any day. So in that world, those secondary markets still might have fairly high home prices, but you would see a correction in the larger cities. On the other hand, if work from home doesn't persist, then I think the Toronto market goes back to what it's been for the last 10 years or so, where, you know, more and more families coming in. And there's also the international component to it, that a lot of the price growth, again, is driven by things like express entry visas. So you look at the tech firms in Kitchener-Waterloo, are they going to decide to continue to bring in workers and, you know, have them move to Kitchener-Waterloo, or are they going to say, you know what, you can work for our company, but you can still, you know, live in whatever country you live in now? So we really don't have a sense that this is going to play out. And since we haven't had a pandemic in over 100 years, in a very different economic environment, there is no playbook to go on. You know, we're all trying to sort of figure this out. You know, we're building the plane in midair, I suppose you could say.
The last pandemic was coincidentally the last time a 3-bedroom home was affordable in Toronto.
It's probably true. it certainly feels true.
Yeah. Before I let you go, over the next few months, again, as we hopefully come out of this, what indicators will you be really paying attention to figure out which of those paths you mentioned will be going down? Is it just the number of international workers and students who come back to cities?
So that would be part of it. So part, I'm looking at, what's happening to the sort of downtown locations. One of the fastest ways to know whether or not workers are going back to the office in Toronto is see the activity that's happening in, the restaurants and the coffee shops in the PATH network in downtown Toronto.
Right.
That's going to be the sort of quickest indicator whether or not those workers are coming back, is to see the activity, the congestion. Google tracks these things. You know, Google has activity map. They look at, you know, how many people are traveling from one place or another. So there's a lot of commuting data you can look at. I will absolutely be looking at the international student numbers in September, October. I think those are going to be really fascinating. I think they're an underrated indicator, particularly in the Southern Ontario market, that I don't think enough people look at. So, you know, seeing what those numbers are, I think is going to give us a real idea of what the housing market looks like, particularly in our college and university towns. So our Torontos, our Londons, and our Kingstons. And so on. So those are the ones that I'd be looking at, and just as well as sales numbers. So not just what's happening on the price side, but what's happening on the number of houses available for sale. How quickly is that stock turning over, and those sorts of indicators may give us an idea of what the next 12 to 18 months look like.
Mike, thank you so much for explaining this to me. It's really helpful.
No, thank you for having me.
Mike Moffitt, an economist at the Smart Prosperity Institute. That was The Big Story. If you'd like more, head to thebigstorypodcast.ca. Yes, we have done episodes on unaffordable housing in the past, and I am assuming this one will also not be the last word. You can find us on Twitter at TheBigStoryFPN. You can complain there about just how unlikely you are to ever own a home. You can also write us a letter via email, thebigstorypodcast, all one word, all lowercase, at rci.rogers.com. You can ask us any questions. We'll try to answer them. And you can rate us and review us and leave a comment, because we love to read them in any podcast player you like. Thank you for listening. I'm Jordan Heath-Rawlings. We'll talk tomorrow.